Thank you, Brian. That was beautiful. I am so honored to be here. I appreciate this opportunity to share my experience, strength, and hope. I'm very grateful to Al-Anon. It's changed my life in so many wonderful ways. And I'm super grateful for my home group, Saturday Sunrise. It's been a wonderful experience being part of that tribe. It's meant so much to me, and I love seeing them every week. So I'm just going to start with what it was like. And I was born the second daughter of two teenage parents. They were very young, inexperienced. They both dropped out of high school. They didn't know each other very long when they got married, well, pregnant with my sister. As a child, I couldn't have worded it, but looking back now, I had a sense of feeling like a burden because they were just so overwhelmed, you know. And talking with my sister later in life, she kind of felt the same way. Like, you know, they had the unplanned pregnancy, so the unplanned marriage, and that's what people did back then. They got married. Neither came from homes with where healthy, respectful relationships were modeled. So they had nothing really to build a life on at their young age. They were just trying to figure it out. When they got married, my mom was 17 and my dad was 19. So the other thing about my parents is my mom is half Filipino and my dad was Caucasian. And my sister and my mom were brown and brown-eyed. And me and my dad were really fair skin and blue eyed. So we look like two different sets of families. And it might not sound like a big deal, but we heard about it all the time. And I always heard, you're just like your dad. And as I continue, you'll see why that means something. my mom and my sister are quiet. My dad was, and I were more outgoing, but there's more to the story. my parents were both hard workers, but my dad always had problems keeping jobs. I didn't know as a child that drinking might have been a factor. I did know there was a lot of tension in my house as best as a child could. You know, I could feel it, but I didn't have words for it. I would watch TV shows like comedies and family dramas and long for families like those. That's what I wanted. I wanted, you know, where everybody seemed to like each other and a sense of ease and lightness, or like rom-coms, you know, half hour later, everybody's in love. And that is not what I was living in. And, you know, for me, that's when I began comparing my inside feelings to what I saw other people's outside appearances. Thinking like all I could see was that one dimension of them, and it's like, wow, they all look happy, you know, and they all seem to like each other, and that's not what's going on here at my house. And that was kind of like the beginning of my compare and despair habit, you know. I always came out on the low end of the compare. So the other thing about my parents is I don't remember any loving gestures between my parents, like hugging or laughing. I don't remember much friendliness at all, except for with the dogs. Like, everybody was really nice to the dog, you know? And we had cats, and we had a rabbit, and we had a hamster, I remember, and fish, and we even had a seahorse. So we all had the thing about animals, just not each other, looking back. One of the very best things, it's like a highlight of my childhood, I remember, was my mom would took us to the library, and I got my own library card. I was about 5 years old. I was like, look at my card, man. I was so proud of it. And I'd get stacks of books, and that's when my love affair with books started, and it's always been a part of my life. And I remember one of the earliest books I read was Heidi. You know, she lived in the Swiss Alps, and her grandfather just loved her and doted on her. And I wanted to be Heidi, you know, and just funny little story. I had this pet mouse and it was a boy, but I named him Heidi. And we used to hide green beans in my Barbie dollhouse for Heidi to find, you know, and there was really not a lot of lightness in my house, but there's these little pockets that I remember, like me and my dad hiding these little green beans under Barbie's bed and Heidi doing something to lift it and get it up. And I kind of treasure those little glimpses because I know they, now I know they were just people, you know, but when you're a little kid, they're everything. So a few memories that stand out to me regarding alcohol in early life was, I remember my dad being pulled over in the car and he was drinking and the police let him go. And what I really remember was my mom being hot. She was really mad. I think she was embarrassed. And I remember that feeling of anger at my dad as long as I can remember. You know, my dad, there's just so much tension between them. And my dad had like two personalities. When he was drinking, he laughed a lot. And it was like this loud, booming laugh that everybody talked about. Like, did you hear Ted's laugh? My God, and you could hear it down the street. Where me and my sister were like, oh, yeah, it's not that fun. And but on the other hand, when he wasn't drinking, he was short-tempered. He was, he could be really kind of have a mean streak. He was no fun to be around at all. he disciplined very harshly with either spankings. I was on restriction a lot because I never knew when to shut up. My sister was so good at it. She was like, zip it. I couldn't do that for some reason. So he'd like, go to your room. And me and my sister still joke about that. Like, technically, I'm probably still on restriction. But it's a kind of weird dynamic, wanting to love your father, you know, see him do so many things that make your mom upset, and at the same time, fearing him. You know, it's like all these different things. I remember one time my dad got really drunk at a wedding, and he picked up the bride while dancing with her that he hardly even knew her, and it didn't go over well. Her brothers all came in and there was all this stuff going on that I didn't really know, other than we left immediately afterwards. And my mom was, oh, I could just feel it. She was hot. I think the bride was the daughter of a coworker. So it wasn't just, it was somebody that she had to see again. And I don't really remember, you know, big discussions about my drinking, my dad's drinking. What I remember is the tension and the anger, you know, always. It's like you could cut it with a knife in my house. Like, it was like my dad was, mom was mad at dad, and dad was kind of irritated with me and my sister a lot, except for when he was drunk. Then he wanted to be Mr. Fun Guy, but me and my sister are like, you're not that fun. And it just really didn't go well. You know, though, I think because I looked like him and I had similar personality traits, I felt like I somehow was like, I don't know how to put it, like kind of enmeshed with him. And I worried about him a lot. He was a young kid. I kept wishing he would change. Doesn't that sound like a good Al-Anon? I wish he would just stop drinking and change and life would be better. I really resented him for not doing what my mom wanted so we could, you know, be that sitcom family that I loved to watch on TV. I feared him because he disciplined us harshly, you know, with the yelling, spanking, restriction. And it was just a lot for a young kid to try to process. And what I know now is like when you grow up in that environment, you blame yourself. You think it's your fault somehow. If like, if I was a better kid, you know, maybe things would be different and you think something's wrong with you. At least that's my understanding of the experience and what I've heard many people share. As a kid is when I developed anxiety, really, about and obsessive worrying and thinking about my family situation, because it felt so tenuous and so like it could fall apart at any moment. It didn't feel safe, like a safe haven, like I would think is ideal for growing up healthy. Mostly what I wished for was there wasn't so much anger. You know, it's like the anger bothered me as much as the drinking, because we were walking on tiptoes because of both. I remember when I was about 8 years old, I ran up to my mom and I hugged her while she was ironing one day. And she just kind of took me and pushed me away. And I could feel her irritation. And I did not see it as she was annoyed with me in the moment. I saw it as I was an annoyance. It's just, I can remember that as a kid, and somehow I knew not to touch her anymore. And it remained that way the rest of her life. I never hugged my mom again. And she was the one that nobody touched. She just did not want to be touched. And as a kid, I really didn't understand that, you know, and thank God, you know, I know a lot more about it now. But what my mom did do was she was the one who got up every day. She paid the bills. She made sure, you know, we had food, that we were taken care of, whatever school supplies. So what she couldn't be there for in tenderness, she was there in like this staunch reliability. And I kind of put her on a pedestal. It's like, because my dad was so the opposite. It was like, okay, mom's superhuman and dad's just blowing it, you know, and my parents didn't try to change our mind. They let us, you know, figure out however we figured it out. So it took me a long time just to see them as human beings. You know, we were left to our own devices to interpret what their unraveling relationship meant. And you know, it's, as a kid, it's really hard to go, oh, this means this. It's all kind of messy. And I remember at some point my dad became a biker, and he had lots of friends around with Harleys, and they were always drinking and smoking dope. And my dad became a custom painter of bikes and cars. And I kind of liked it. I kind of liked the whole easy rider biker crowd, because they laughed a lot. And I really longed for some laughter and lightness by then. But this divided my parents, you know, even more. I think about when I was 10, I asked my mom, like, so are you going to divorce him? I remember asking her like that. And she was like, she just looked at me and didn't say a word. But I remember feeling very brave that I asked that question. It was like, I'm going to show you, mom. I know what's going on here. This isn't good. It's not like on TV. I don't know what the deciding factor was, but they divorced when I was 13, and I only saw my dad off and on for many years after that. And all my aunts and uncles were still married. They were the first divorce on both sides of our family. And it was like one more reason to feel kind of different and kind of ashamed, like there was something wrong with our family unit, my dad, my mom, me, and my sister. You know, I was looking at their outsides, like they look good, to my parents' marriage inside, what I witnessed, you know, and I didn't have the maturity to know that every marriage has problems. I just kept thinking, oh, our house has problems. Our family's broken. You know, we don't know how to do life right, is the kind of thoughts I had. So that's kind of where we were. And, you know, being that my parents were so young, I think when they divorced, they just got to go be adults for the first time. You know, so I didn't see my dad for a long time. And my mom started doing some things she probably always wanted to do. And they just, me and my sister were teens, and, you know, they just really kind of let us be. And it was fine for my sister. She was much more, she liked rules. She was a really big fan of them. And she got a boyfriend and stayed with them for years. And for me, I did what my dad did. I had my first drink of alcohol at 14, and I liked the calming effect. And all my friends were beginning to drink too. And it didn't work out any better for me than it did my dad. Except when I got pulled over, I actually got DUIs. I had two DUIs by the time I was 19. And it's a funny thing, on my second DUI, my dad bailed me out of jail. And years later, I found out he was drunk that night. You know, I couldn't tell. But, and then the next thing I did is I married my longtime boyfriend at 23. We both drank a lot. I think we got married because nothing else was working. We both were as dysfunctional as the families we came from. We had all the problems that alcohol-fueled relationships have. I wanted him to calm like every doubt and insecurity that I developed long before I met him. And he seemed to like being with other women every now and then. That was his thing. And it didn't go well. So we had this big, dramatic, drunken mess. I was full of self-pity and resentment. And I was still like a scared little girl wishing for dad and mom to come make it a happily ever after. And so we got divorced, and I found my very first 12-step meeting. I learned about 12-step meetings from reading a book, of course, Elizabeth Taylor's biography. She went to the Betty Ford Center and then attended 12-step meetings. And that's how I knew about it. You know, I was really scared to step into a room of 12-step meetings. It's not like I was just scared to be seen, you know, because I felt like people would see right through my skin and feel all the crazy emotional mess that I felt back then. And my experience with my first few meetings wasn't like that at all. I felt welcome from day one. You know, let me see. For me, like, it was so good to feel part of. It was like the first few years that I imagined high school would be like if you felt like you fit in. You know, it's like, I belong here in these rooms. People are talking my language. And they're talking about their drinking, but they're talking about their parents drinking. And I feel like I belong here, you know, and that alone was so huge for me to just actually belong somewhere. And, you know, I remember telling my dad one time that I'm going to these meetings and it's really helping me. And he goes, yeah, well, be careful. Those people have problems. And I just thought, oh my God, Dad, really? and I did everything I was supposed to do for a while. I got a sponsor, I worked steps, and I really, really benefited from being in that program. But I still had a whole lot of growing up to do. I always looked outside of myself for that feeling completion. You know, I always felt like something was missing, and getting that something would, you know, fill that hole where confidence and wholesomeness and feeling like part of would always be there, you know. But I always looked outside instead of inside, even though in the rooms I heard, you know, it's an inside job, but I was like, yeah, sure it is. I still wanted a relationship. I still kind of thought that was the secret sauce, you know, to serenity, I guess. So I met Paul, my husband, at a 12-step meeting. We had some mutual friends. I thought he was a pretty cool guy, you know. Mostly I liked that he had blonde hair, blue eyes, and a Harley, because I hadn't been divorced long, and I thought, okay, we could just, you know, be friends, have fun together, keep it light, as if I know how to have fun, light relationships at that point. our first date was a big speaker meeting, and it was uncomfortable. Neither one of us talked much, and we just didn't even vibe. You know, it just was weird. I thought, oh boy, did I get him wrong? You know, he is boring. And he called me back a week later and he asked me out for dinner. And I said, sure, why not? And thinking, you know, we could just be program friends. And we've been together ever since, actually. It's been 29 years this year. And that night, we just hit it off. We talked about everything. I think coming from the anonymous programs gave us a level of intimacy that might take longer for others outside of the program to have. Like, we were already like going to topics that were pretty deep, you know, we bonded over that. And we both came from families with the same dynamics, lots of substance abuse and dysfunctions, parents that showed no warmth toward each other physically or verbally. And one of the things we said to each other is like, we totally know what we don't want. Maybe we could figure out what we want, because we both had had so much of what we didn't want. And, you know, we set off to live our lives. And as, and of course, you know, life has lots of surprises, as it should. He shared with me pretty early on that he had a 9-year-old daughter whose mother was dying of AIDS. And it didn't scare me off. Although I never experienced, I still had that kind of, you know, a love will conquer all attitude. You know, those were always my favorite kind of movies and books. The ones where, you know, with the right circumstances, enough love, enough togetherness, happy ending. So I thought, you know, we could do this. I know her mother's dying. We, you know, we could raise her. And eventually I met her, and she was something else. She was like a hurricane. She asked me for my phone number the very first night we met. And she called me like an hour after I got home. She's like, what are you doing now? And she like called me all the time, his little 9-year-old daughter. And she was lively and very strong-willed. And she grew up with a lot of freedom and leniency because her mom had been sick so much. And my husband wasn't very close with her until he got sober. So when we got married at 11, I was really friendly with her mom, Judy, and she thanked me numerous times for being Kelly's life, because she knew she wasn't going to be. I was really, really grateful that she was able to attend our wedding, Judy, and see Kelly as a flower girl. That was really meaningful to me. And because, you know, I respect commitments that I make, and I have a tendency to be overly responsible, a tendency I now know is common when growing up in alcoholic homes, I took the role of being Kelly's stepmom very seriously. She moved in with us when we were married only a couple months. And about that same time, you know, I was starting to struggle with food. And really what I had done was replace alcohol with food. I used food, mostly sugar and carbs, as a way to numb myself when emotions were too uncomfortable. Now the circumstance I needed to be happy was to be thin or not overeating, since I had got the marriage and relationship and found out that wasn't it after all. And of course, I turned to books to figure out the food problem. I went to a retreat in Austin, Texas, based on a book I read on emotional eating. It was an okay retreat. I met a lot of people and learned some things. But what happened there, I still so vividly remember, is I was sitting in a room with a lot of women, and we were all listening to the author speak. There was a lot of emotional and vulnerable sharing, and I was very open from hearing people share at such gut level. And then I felt like I was getting sick, like I had a fever going through me, and I started to sweat and have chills, and I thought I might be sick. And then I just heard the words, "She means so much to me. Please don't forget how much she means to me." And the tone was really kind, but somewhat urgent. And I've never felt anything like this before or since, but I knew it was Judy, Kelly's mom. And I called my husband about an hour later and asked if something was going on with her. And he asked me, how'd you know? She had just died about an hour ago. And Paul and Kelly were with her. And I could even feel it now. I just remember so vividly what that was like. And I feel it was almost like she was past me then. Because ever since then, I've always thought of her as my daughter. And we started our lives as a family of three. You know, it was challenging. I thought being sober and together would be enough. And we were not prepared for the future at all because my daughter, Callie, ran away for the first time at 15. And she began abusing alcohol and drugs. And we sent her to many treatment facilities. And sometimes she'd be asked to leave because she was too disruptive. I mean, that was shocking to me that, you know, I think here you guys are here to help people that are on the fringe and you're asking us to take our daughter home because she's too disruptive. And we just were so overwhelmed. And about that time, you know, CPS got involved and we had to go to court and the court case was thrown out. And this just went on and on. Overdoses and cutting. There was lots of doctors, police, and lawyers in our life at this point. And I agonized over it. I mean, I was heartsick. I thought about it day and night. I was obsessed with it. You know, I'd give lip service to trusting a higher power, hers and mine, but I didn't. I knew I was supposed to believe this, but I couldn't. It's like my fear was so much bigger than my faith. I thought a good mother would know what to do. You know, again, comparing what I saw outside, it looked easy, to what I was feeling inside, completely helpless, powerless, just lost. And I'm sure my husband could say he felt very much the same way. And, you know, I look back at it now, I was obsessed with worrying with Kelly, like I was obsessed with worrying about my dad. You know, in retrospect, I replaced my dad with Kelly. I just went from one to the other. It was like a new self-destructive, chemically addicted person to obsess about. So, you know, we just kept doing the best we could. And at this point, my career was increasing, a lot of responsibility. I was promoted to a manager and I had like 35 people under me. And I remember sitting at my desk one day and my daughter was in this high-level treatment program and they called me and said she just tried to hang herself. And I just was barely able to breathe, but just continued to do my job, you know. I was very much like my own mother. I just worked. I just kept working. And that, I think, is actually what kept me sane. But this is the time that I kind of walked away from the 12-step world. And, you know, looking back, bad decision. It wasn't a conscious choice. It just seemed like between my job and my family demanded so much attention and I was exhausted because that's all I focused on. I felt like I didn't have a choice, you know? And after she became an adult, I learned to let go somewhat, you know? It did help me to think she has her own higher power. And I don't know what's best for her, you know? The humility in that. I don't know. I remember just saying, I don't know, and how calming that was to me. But then, so things were starting to settle down, but not long before my husband shattered his ankle at work. And when he was recovering, he was diagnosed with tonsil cancer that metastasized to his neck. And so he had two surgeries for his foot and two surgeries for his neck and a lot of radiation. So he's really sick. And about that time, his father and then his brother died within a year. His brother died of the same kind of cancer. And it was just one of the most painful times in our adult life. And I wasn't attending meetings and I didn't have any affiliation with the spiritual community. And I just kind of lost myself and gained 50, 60 pounds and just felt like life was chaotic, you know? And I was here, I wasn't worried about an alcoholic, but I was worried about a sick person. which is basically the same thing. You know, I was worried about my husband. I was worried about how he was doing with the death of his father and brother. And as you can see, the theme here is like, nowhere in there is, am I taking care of me? this was a tough time for us in this same period. Besides my two in-laws dying, a dear friend died, and a 26-year-old that I had known since she was a child died very randomly. Even my husband's orthopedist son, daughter-in-law, two children died in a small plane crash. And this all happened within 14 months or so. And it was just like, not only before I didn't know how to do life, but then I really felt like I was losing it. You know, like, what is this? And I started studying different spiritualities and like Buddhism. And it really was comforting to me that the Buddha walked out of the palace and he saw for the first time that people aged, got ill, and died. And I think that's for the very first time I was like, oh yeah, this isn't happening to me. This isn't like some kind of insult. This is life. People age, get sick, and die. But I think learning different spiritual things, but not having a community, didn't really give it the power it could have. So as time passed, my first grandson was born in 2012, and Kelly had moved in with us, my daughter, at about 5 months pregnant, and she had him and left 6 weeks later. And I was really sick about this. It was like, oh good, now I have one more life to obsess about, you know, my dad, my husband, Kelly, baby. And it just turned my crazy on full volume. Though I didn't see her often, again, I was thinking about her and my grandson all the time. I kept wondering if I should do something, but I didn't know what to do. But I kept having the thought go through my head, I should do something. It's really not a good thought when you really don't know what to do. It's exhausting. You know, me and my husband would talk about it over and over, but it was just, it was exhausting. And I'd Google Child Protective Services, but never contact them. I was just in this loop. And I wanted to be this doting grandma, not this freaked out obsessive one. But it just didn't happen. You know, it was just a lot more of the same of what I had experienced about obsessing over people in my life. And in 2014, she told me she was going to have another baby. And I was like, are you kidding? That's the last thing you need. But I didn't say that. She didn't agree with me. She thought it was what she wanted. And, you know, I just wallowed. With the first baby, I didn't think I could worry anymore. With this second baby, there was a new depth of just despair. And I just really kind of want to illuminate what a mess I was. Back then, because she moved out of California then. She thought she was going to go have the baby somewhere else. And she called me and said, this isn't working out either. I'm coming back. And that was it for me. I felt like my brain broke. And I started Googling Al-Anon, and I was at my first meeting within days. And it was a Saturday sunrise meeting. And I have not left that meeting since. That's my home group. And I've learned so much there. And I treasure the people in those rooms. I think one of the very first things I heard was, love the person, hate the disease. And that really, I felt that in my heart, like immediately. I had the two. Enmeshed together, you know, I couldn't separate them. But when I heard that, was the very first little bit of being able to separate the disease from that person's humanity. And I always focused on the problematic aspects of people rather than their wholeness, you know, mainly my dad and my daughter, because I feel like even now I've given you all this, but really there was other sides to them as well. you know, but I always focused on the alcoholism, the problems, the things that scared me. And so right away, gosh, I remember with the first 3 to 4 weeks of Al-Anon, I got these insights like boom, boom, boom. It's like, I saw very early on that I took my daughter's alcoholism so personally, you know, as if her disease was being done to me. Like, I didn't think like, oh, she's doing this to me. But in a way, I kind of did, you know, as if I were a victim of her alcoholism. And, you know, since every victim needs a villain, I was making her into a villain of my life. You know, my life was just as unmanageable as hers. She had a drinking problem and I had a thinking problem. I resented her the way my dad resented my mom. You know, I hated that so much from my mom that she was had that anger all the time. And I ended up being like that to Kelly. And it, actually that having that anger kind of helped me understand. My mom probably felt like I did. She didn't know what to do. She was lost. She was overwhelmed. So I wasn't proud of myself, what I was learning, but God, it was such a relief that there were answers and solutions. And there was people showing me that it was possible. You know, I just soaked up every share in every meeting I went to, you know, because that experience was so different than the experience I had had. And I believed them, you know, when I heard it could be different, I believed it right away. And also I think I was exhausted enough to just, yes, there's gotta be a better answer because my decisions and defenses didn't work. You know, I just kind of kept going round and round. So I began to look a little deeper. And I saw that I really didn't have a lot of help to give my daughter, that I kept thinking I have to help her or even my dad, I have to help him. I didn't have anything to do because I was just as addicted to fear and control as they were to substances. You know, we had a lot in common. We were in a lot of emotional pain and we didn't know what to do for ourselves. And we needed a spiritual solution, you know, and we needed to be bigger than our fears. But we needed to do it separately. I had to let them go, you know, and I slowly began to put the focus on my own life. And I slowly learned how to turn it over to a higher power. My worries about my daughters, my dad, my grandsons, my husband. And I began to see how I had become enmeshed in all their lives. Like, I can't be happy until they're okay. And I didn't even know I really had that going on, but with the writing that we do in here, it's like, I sure did, you know, I really did. And I don't even know if it was really all that benevolent. It was more because their out of controlness scared me. So I kept focusing on it and I wanted things to calm down so I could calm down. I wanted to live from the outside in. I wanted they to be happy, calm, and then I could be. And it was all kind of under the radar, you know. One of the things that I kind of got early on too is that there was really nothing to forgive because forgiving, you know, this is the way I saw it then, was forgiving them supported the idea that they did something to me. And especially my daughter, she didn't. She was living her life in a way that I didn't agree with, basically. That I didn't want her to. And after, you know, she became an adult, I wasn't responsible anymore. And I kept saying things like, well, as a mother, how do you know when it's time to quit, you know, being responsible, isn't it? But in some ways, I think I was kind of making excuses for my inability to let go of it. You know, I think accepting my powerlessness over other people is very freeing. It's like the intelligent use of my thoughts and energy. You know, it's exhausting when I try to force my will onto others by trying to control. And it's just as dysfunctional as the people that, you know, were my qualifiers. It was such a dynamic time for me, like that first year in the program. I began seeing so much as like I had so many things backwards. Accepting my powerless over people and places and things means to me, I stopped judging the people in my life who are, in my opinion, struggling and start doing something about my own struggles. I accept that there is nothing I can do to change anyone, and I quit using my precious time on earth to devise plans and schemes to fix people so I can relax. And like I said earlier, it wasn't as benevolent as it might have looked. I began to see the arrogance and thinking that I knew best. I also saw that a lot of times my help was really trying to manipulate situations so I could think about it in such a way that I would feel comfortable. You know, I accepted that most of the pain in my life is created by my thoughts that things should be different as they are. You know, the unwillingness to accept life on life's terms. That just created a lot of resentment and self-pity and anxiety. Then I blamed my circumstances for creating the feelings rather than my thoughts about those circumstances. You know, it was like a lot of growing up I needed to do. And what's funny to me about that, as long as I can remember, when I prayed to God, I'd always say, God, help me grow up. Like I kind of knew I really needed to grow up. I just didn't know how. When I heard the three C's, I didn't cause it, I can't control it, and I can't cure it, I felt like I was taking a deep cleansing breath. It was like, yes, it isn't my fault. You know, and I think growing up with alcoholism so prevalent in my life, I had that belief that so many kids do that grow up that way, that it was if I had been different somehow, maybe it would have been different. So those three C's helped me in my today's world with my daughter, but it also helped heal something from long, long ago. It opened up space, you know, for me to start seeing things different. I heard this quote I'm going to read to you about space that I say often to me because I feel it's very program related. It goes between stimulus and response, there is a space. And in that space is our power to choose our response. In our freedom lies the growth. In our freedom lies our growth and our freedom. I'm not saying that right. Between stimulus and response, there is a space. In that space is our power to choose our response. And in our response lies our growth and our freedom. And I have it here on my desk. I see it all the time because before coming in Al-Anon, I was always like impulsive. And now it's like, have that space, you know, make a decision. In that space is my freedom, my power. When I rush, when I act on urges, I lose all my power. I lose my freedom. You know, I'm just acting out of fear. And I believe that, you know, in this space is where all growth happens. It doesn't happen when I'm trying to manipulate and control my world. There's no space there because when I'm doing that, it's super tight. And I have a really dear friend who just this week said to me that, you know, right now my higher power is space. And I thought that was perfect. I just thought that was perfect that she saw that. And I love all the slogans I heard in the rooms. One of the ones I say to myself a lot still is feelings aren't facts. I love weight. Why am I talking? And waste. Why am I still talking? You know, because I know if I'm still talking, I got a motive. I like Q-tip. Quit taking it personally. I think that's really adorable. Detach. Don't even think about changing him and her. That's perfect. I mean, that says it all. Kiss. Keep it simple, sweetheart. I don't say stupid. I like sweetheart. I actually didn't know this one until I looked it up. Don't be jaded. Jaded is for justified, argue, defend, and explain. And of course, progress, not for perfection. principles above personalities, and of course, let go and let God, you know? And one of the most healing parts of joining Al-Anon for me is the connection and community I have found in this fellowship. I related to the pain that people that have shared, and by, you know, regarding their loved ones, I heard the toll it took on them. I heard how they are now focusing on themselves. I knew I was welcomed and I knew I belonged. I soaked up the compassion and encouragement and understanding that I didn't know how to give to myself. And I didn't know in other areas of my life. And I don't know if it wasn't not there or I was too scared to let it in. And what I learned, which is super healing, is I'm not unique. You know, there's nothing very unique about me. I'm from a family with alcoholism, and I have family members that are near and dear to me that's also still continue to struggle with the disease of alcoholism. And I have a program now that, thank God, helps me treats my disease. You know, it's not about them, it's about me. And it's so good to say that, because for many years I didn't know that. I got a sponsor very early on and helped me feel part of, and gave me someone to discuss the more personal situations. And I got to hear her experiences, and it helped heal the isolation and the shame that some of these secrets create. And she was such fantastic help to me. And, you know, this is how God works. Her husband had the exact same kind of cancer my husband did, and it's not a common form of cancer. So we got to talk about that and share our experiences with that, because it's a type of cancer that affects you the rest of your life. And I mean, what a gift that was. You know, I just feel like God knows what's best for me sometime, you know, and I don't even know. It was just this feeling, ask her to be a sponsor. You know what I mean? And I just text her, will you sponsor me? And she did for a few years, and it was wonderful. And then she moved away. But I got so much out of that relationship. And I've always had a belief in a higher power, fascinated by all things spiritual, knowing that, you know, we're so much more than just this human biology. And since coming into Al-Anon, this belief for me has deepened and become so much more meaningful and so much more real, and like I can feel it. And I've come to believe that we are human and spiritual beings at the same exact time. And I love in these rooms that we all have different concepts, and then we can change our concept. And I never expect anybody to have the same belief as mine. I love that in here, that, oh, tell me what yours is, instead of, oh, it's different. You know, I think that whoever came up with that was brilliant. Just kidding. One thing that, since I've been in Al-Anon, that's helped me a lot, and I share this with the gals I've sponsored, and I see that it's helped them, that I study the brain in very simplistically, and I've learned how we have like a lower reptilian brain, and humans have what's called a prefrontal cortex right on top of that. But the reptilian brain's still there, that has the whole fight, flight, freeze, feed mechanism that acts impulsively, takes everything personal. Its main focus is survival, and it sees discomfort as a threat. And the prefrontal cortex can make long-range plans and consider our words and actions and learn new ways of being, like we do here in Al-Anon. And this knowledge, how it's helped me, how it works here, is it's helped me quit judging myself when my lower brain is doing exactly what it's supposed to do, look for threats. I used to take the urge to control or the urge to obsess about others so personally, as if I wasn't getting it or not working a good enough program. When I learned about how the brain works, it was like easier to dismiss those urges and understand what it is. You know, that's just the reptilian brain. I am working a program. Having urges or impulsive thoughts is meaningless. It means nothing. And that helped me a lot, because I used to really judge myself on those first thoughts. Like, wouldn't those be gone if I was doing better? and learning this about the brain really changed a lot for me. And I have this really good friend, she's here right now. And we always say, well, of course my brain wants to control, or of course my brain's all activated, you know, or we just, of course, because it just neutralizes all that. And I don't have to even pay attention to, you know, my urge to control. Of course it's there. And now I can move right past that, you know? And I think the slogan that really, really applies to this is feelings aren't facts. They're just feelings. And a lot of them are just programmed. They've been coming at you for years. And now we could just dismiss them. And that's really helped me accept myself and have more self-compassion and more understanding of myself. Because, you know, I believe outside of our intellect, our brains, we are connected to our higher power. A lot of times I just call it wisdom. And sometimes I just call it love. And I think when we align with that wisdom, acceptance, love, tolerance, all makes sense. You know, like when I align with fear, those things don't make sense. But when I align with the wisdom that I believe is in like every DNA strand I have, then it just makes sense. It's just like, you know, I'm going to follow this. I'm going to align with wisdom. And it feels like a choice and it feels very real to me. And I was never able to access this before Al-Anon because there's just too much fear. You know, and my focus was too much on everybody else. And, you know, I judged the alcoholics in my life because I was scared. I was scared of mostly how I felt about their unpredictability. And as a child, for desire, you know, for a calm and loving life began, and that desire remained as strong. Al-Anon has helped me see that I had to think differently to feel differently. And that's where the calm and love would finally come in. I had to think different thoughts. I had to learn our program. I had to reprogram myself. You know, I want to think those old thoughts, but now it's like I have to think different thoughts to get different results, to create different feelings, to, you know, fuel different actions. You know, I started to see the innocence in all human beings. And I think because this program is so loving, it was a natural byproduct for me. It's like some people overdrink and some overeat and some try to control their whole environment and some do all of the above. You know, I've dabbled in all. When I did my 4-step in Al-Anon, I saw that I had a lot of resentments and each one basically came down to people weren't playing the roles I assigned them. I especially saw this with my daughter, my husband, and my family of origin, you know, all my loved ones. And I arrogantly had like a manual for each of them and then resented them when they didn't follow it. And I began to, this was a huge awareness for me. And I began to see it in many areas of my life, from coworkers, drivers, politicians, you know, you don't follow my manual, I resent you. And I really started being responsible for my own experience rather than blaming people, places, and things for how I was feeling. And that manual and that 4-step was seeing like, here's your role. If you don't feel it, I have a grudge. It's just, you know, we actually were laughing because it just, I could see myself in like this director garb yelling at everybody trying to do this movie. And me and my sponsor are like, you know, it's so ridiculous what we do when you can finally see it, even if you've been doing it for 50 years and how fast it could change. You know, for that, it was like a moment where I saw things completely differently. It's like, oh, it's not them. It's my script. So with that insight, my relationships really did begin to improve. My husband said he could feel I had less attention on him and I wasn't so invested in how he was behaving. And he said he liked it. I can only imagine. I stopped critiquing his comment. We quit talking about his tone of voice. We talked about his tone of voice for years. And, you know, I let him be him. Finally, it's like, here he is, my loved one that I'm always trying to, you know, mold and shape. And that was a gift that I wasn't even looking for coming into Al-Anon. It made my marriage so much better. And to this day, my marriage is wonderful. And it's, I would say within the first 6 months of being in Al-Anon, my marriage got better. And my relationship with my daughter now is just, it's beautiful. You know, sometimes she's been sober, sometimes she's not. But I find that doesn't even matter to me. Of course, I wish the best for her. But what I know now is I love her. And I'm not going to pull that love away from her if she's not following my manual. I love her, period. You know, and she hasn't really, I think she can, just like my husband, she can feel I'm not judging her. She could feel the acceptance. I'm not saying to you, hey, I don't accept you. I accept you. I don't judge you anymore. You know, it wasn't necessary because she could feel it. She could see that I wasn't asking pointed questions like, oh, did you do this or that? So, I mean, that was such a gift that I have the family right now that I love, that's peaceful. When we get together, everybody is glad to see each other. We hug each other. It's so different than how I grew up and so different from how this family actually started. Just to finish up, step six to me was very freeing because at this point, I want to see what's keeping me from serenity and expansion. I want to grow. So when I'm looking at my character defects, I know it's going to lead to growth and I'm all in, you know. I saw that arrogance is like, I know how things should be. See my manual. And self-pity is like, I feel sorry for myself because things aren't the way I think they should be. And defensiveness, there must be something wrong with me because things aren't the way they should be. And resentment, I'm mad because things aren't the way they should be, you know, and unresolved grief, I'm sad because things weren't the way they should be. And I know this sounds repetitive, but that's what I learned. It's like, I thought things should be a certain way. And when they weren't, I was arrogant. I felt sorry for myself. I was defensive, resentful. And it wasn't pretty, but because I believed in this program so much, I knew this information was going to give me something I didn't have before. And that was growth and humility, you know, and I totally believe that God wanted nothing but growth, happiness, and joy for me and would remove those shortcomings. It's like, I kind of feel like when I was doing my sixth step, God was right there going like, yeah, keep going. That's great. Come on, let's do this. So in step seven, you know, I aligned with my higher power, and the more I aligned with that and believed that God would remove these shortcomings, I just felt more and more free. You know, I think humility is like a game changer. There's this saying out there that I really like that says, I don't know, but I know the one who does know. And when I say that to myself, it just calms me. It's like, it tells me it's okay, I don't know, but it cements that relationship. But I know the one who does know, and I'm good. And that's just everything to me. So I've made, you know, mostly living amends, and I treat the people in my life differently. I'm respectful of others no matter how they live their lives. And that's so important to me. I don't get to treat people differently. I treat all people the same, and it's something very important to me. And recently, I got a big moment to see my growth because in April, I was told my daughter is pregnant again. And my reaction, and it didn't take a lot of work either, it was total love and support. That was it. We got this little, because we're in the pandemic, right? We can't see each other. I got this envelope in the mail that said open together. I thought it was an Easter card from our grandsons. We opened it up and it's this oven that says, hey, we got a bun in the oven. And me and my husband were like, oh my God. But the reason that this was such a big deal is because when my first grandson, I mean, just brought me to my knees. That's when I was just obsessed and worried and sick. My second grandson brought me into Al-Anon. And my new grandson, he's a boy, I already know, is showing me that it really works if you work it. Just by that reaction I had, I mean, it was just love. It's, you know, it just was a moment of going, wow, these three grandsons are showing me my life and I am grateful. And, you know, it's just really good to have this connection like I've always wanted, not just to my family and my loved ones, but to life, and to feel like I belong just because I'm part of life. And I no longer really compare myself to others, you know, the outside in, or compare my insides to outsides. And I just think one day at a time, sitting in the rooms, sponsoring people, being sponsored, I just got a wonderful new sponsor, it's a beautiful, lovely life. And I couldn't be more grateful, I don't think. And I think I'll wrap it up there. Thank you.